I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Guy Vanderhaeghe has a new collection of short stories, Daddy Lenin and Other Stories. The book has 9 stories, and the reviews of the book have been rather good. Mr. Vanderhaeghe joins me now, and we'll discuss these stories, the art of the short story, and we'll reflect on his distinguished career. He has written numerous books, including My Present Age, Homesick, The Englishman's Boy, The Last Crossing, and A Good Man. His short story collections include Man Descending, The Trouble with Heroes, and Things as They Are. He has received many awards, including the Governor General's Award twice, the Writers' Trust Timothy Findlay Award, the Pierre Trudeau Fellowship, and the Harbourfront Festival Prize. He is an officer of the Order of Canada and a recipient of the Saskatchewan Order of Merit, where he makes his home. This new book is published by McClelland & Stewart. He joined me from here in Vancouver while in town for an appearance with the Writers' Fest last week. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Guy Vanderhaeghe. Mr. Vanderhaeghe, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How often do you teach?
I teach one semester. It's a rather light teaching load, but it sort of gets me out of the house. I'm associating with younger people, which tends to make me kind of consider the art of writing more than perhaps I would if I just had my head buried in what I was doing.
That's at the University of Saskatchewan where you teach, is that right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So you do buy into that idea that from your pupils you are taught, I guess. That.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any question about that. I mean, one of the things that I find or have found over 20 years of teaching, that to attempt to explain how fiction is made, and I think of fiction as being a craft, I have to kind of examine very closely what I might do instinctually. And then when I do that, I think that I actually bring a fresher outlook to my own work. When I was a younger writer, I think that I would have thought that there was a danger in thinking about what I was doing, but now that I'm older, I actually see some benefit in it.
Yeah, and I guess as you get older, I read somewhere, I think you told the Ottawa Citizen this, that there is an urgency to return to one's roots. I mean, do you understand the life a little bit better, that you can take the long view and say, look back?
Well, I don't know if I understand it any better. That might be presumptuous of me to say, but I certainly look at it differently than when I was younger. I think that every age that you inhabit or live gives you a slightly different perspective. And now that I'm in my 60s approaching my middle 60s, I find that I'm looking back more than I'm looking ahead, which I think is only natural. When I was in my 20s and my 30s and beginning to write, I was trying to imagine myself into the future, or that I had hopes about the future as a writer. Now I'm more inclined to look back on the trajectory that my writing life has taken, and then, you know, my own life. And I think that that's true of anybody as they age. They try to build a narrative out of the life that they've lived.
So I'm just wondering, from your middle 60s, is there a new future?
I received a Lifetime Achievement Award about a year ago, and, you know, I said at the banquet in which I got it, you know, does that mean it's all over? I mean, I certainly hope that it isn't all over, but I wouldn't presume to think that I have another 65 years, so it really is a question about, I think, trying to make the most out of the time that's left you. And that's not pessimistic or gloomy or dreary. Mm-hmm. I think it's realistic and a way of approaching life.
The book jacket has a line that says, "Here is a grand master writing at the height of his powers." Does it mean it's all downhill from here?
Possibly it does. I mean, I don't know. I take heart from the idea that. I mean, many writers have produced really, really strong work. in their later years. I mean, if you look at the American writer Cormac McCarthy, mm-hmm. he has been producing, you know, superb work in his 70s and sort of edging into his early 80s. So I guess there is hope even for old codgers like me.
Now, the short story, is that where you started your writing?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that led me to the short story was not just a love of the form, but when I was working full-time, short stories seemed more manageable to write. And so that's how I began to teach myself how to write. Now, when I say that, I'm not being dismissive. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that the short story is a very difficult art form, a very demanding art form. And I love to write them, and I love to read them. But there is a kind of practical concern when you're a writer. Short stories don't tend to sell very well. So if you want to earn a living as a writer, you're almost forced into being a novelist unless you're a handful of extraordinary short story writers like, say, Alice Munro.
Mm-hmm. And if you had to explain it to someone, I mean, the short story is not, say, a novel that's been shortened or truncated. It's a craft unto itself, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in many ways, it might sound like a peculiar thing to say. I think that the short story is closer to poetry than it is the novel.
Mm-hmm.
The great South African writer Nadine Gordimer, who's also a great short story writer, spoke of it as being, you know, the light of fireflies in the night. I think that the short story works like poetry, or that you hope that it works like poetry, that you only really understand what the story means when you come to the last few lines of it, which I think is true of all important poetry. It's a more glancing look at life, and it works in different ways than the novel does.
Do you approach writing a short story, say, differently than a novel, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that the thing about a short story is that what I tend to do is that I envision it in a series of moments. And I think that those moments have to be, or should be, drawn very shortly.
Yeah.
Or sharply, I mean. The novel, I think, is a slower unfolding. It's what you learn about the characters and the plot of a novel, you learn slowly. What you learn about characters or the meaning of the short story, you often learn almost instantly. You get this quick insight, or that's the way many great short stories work.
Yeah, as a reader, I find that there's no time wasted.
No, absolutely not. And it's one of the things that I tell my students that short stories demand that the writer not be self-indulgent. Every word in a short story, every scene, every moment has to serve nothing but the short story. So, I mean, I sometimes jokingly say to them, you know, go back and count out all the things that you are in love with in the story, because often the things that you are in love with are self-indulgent.
Now, the stories in this book feature male characters that run the gamut of maturity, experience. Where do these men come from?
I suppose that, in a sense, these men come out of my past. And when I say that, I don't mean that they're autobiography or even biography. But I was born in 1951, and the men that I grew up with, many of them were, I'm talking about adult men, the men who loomed rather large in my life. They were men who had gone through the Depression, of the 1930s. Many of them had been, were ex-servicemen, as many of my uncles had been, that they had gone through the war. They were the kind of man that I think is almost a dying breed now. And they were the way they were because of their experiences. I mean, I often think of them almost losing 15 years out of their life. The Depression lasted for most of the 30s, and the only thing that, that brought an economic revival in the country was the war, but the war took, you know, 5 to 6 years away from these men's lives, so it was almost as if they lost 15 years of their lives. And having lost 15 years of their lives, they were a different kind of man than the generations that followed them. In many ways, then I write about men who were the sons of that generation, which I'm basically talking about myself then, the experiences that we had growing up in the 50s and 60s and coming to maturity in the 70s, and then following our lives up until the present.
Well, one of the reviews, reviewers, I should say, brought up how masculinity is depicted in one of the stories, and commented on how the concept of masculinity has changed because of, say, the ubiquitous therapy that's become part of our lives and our culture. Do you think it has?
Well, I don't think that there's any question that boys were raised differently when I was a child than the way they're raised now. And that's, you know, that's a product of circumstance. It's not necessarily that one generation is wiser than another generation. It's simply that circumstances provided a different pattern for masculinity. Now, I'm not also suggesting that masculinity is cut and dried. I mean, someone like me, who lived through women's liberation, you know, the changes that brought, meant that our attitudes to women and ourselves changed over time. You know, it's hard for me to say with any certainty that men are a great deal different than they used to be, mm-hmm. but I think that they are different.
Yeah. The men that we meet in this book, some of them we can learn a great deal from. I'm curious to know in terms of the writing, in terms of the exposition, the plotting and the sort, was there one that taught you?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think that probably the story that maybe taught me something or gave me maybe a little bit more insight on my own past was a story called Counselor Sally Takes Me to the Tunnel.
Mm.
And there's a man who's roughly my age who's talking about his experiences with an uncle when he was a young boy. The uncle is one of these men that I mentioned earlier in the interview, in the fact that he was a veteran of the Second World War, and today we would say that he was suffering from post-traumatic
stress disorder.
Now, back then, in the time that I'm writing about, you know, the 50s and the 60s, that concept was more or less foreign. You know, people talked about battle fatigue,
mm-hmm.
But that, you know, I think the assumption was is that once you took someone out of battle and gave them time to recuperate, then they should be all right. So I think in looking back at my memories of the men that I encountered when I was very young and the way they behaved writing the story actually helped me, I think, helped me understand them a little better.
I started that story, and I didn't finish it, because when I went a couple pages into it, I noticed that there was so much that I wanted to ask you about it that I felt I would probably spend the whole 20 minutes talking to you about that one story. And I didn't want to give it away for people listening to us if I did ask you a great number of questions about that. So I found that interesting that you brought that up in terms of something that I guess taught you something about yourself, perhaps.
Well, I think so, because one of the things I think that for men of my age who had these larger-than-life figures, in many ways, you know, like Tom Brokaw spoke of the Americans, and they called them, you know, he called them the greatest generation. They bulked very large, I think, in young boys' minds in the 50s. You know, they were the people who had fought the war, who had won the war, and they did seem, I think they did seem heroic, and I think that often they were such large presences, mm-hmm. that they may have figured too largely in, you know, the imagination of their children.
Who do you think young people today feel figure large in their life?
I would say it's celebrity. I think that you know, the ubiquity of media and social media and fame makes media figures huge figures. I think I read somewhere, statistically speaking, that there was a high percentage of teenagers who, if they were asked, what would they rather be, a professional person or an assistant to a famous person, they were opting, you know, to be an assistant for a famous person in their imagination. I think that those kinds of, I'm guessing here. Yeah. I don't know, but I think that celebrity bulks larger now than it used to. You know, sports celebrity, music celebrity, television, movie celebrity, and you know, even people who I'm not quite sure why they're famous.
Right.
It's only important that they are famous. It's not necessarily what they've done to become famous. It's the simple fact that they're recognized as being huge figures in the culture.
The book also, and not just this book, but I mean your writing in general has been known to depict, say, the prairies or the Saskatchewan that you live in, that you know so well. Do you want us to know something about the prairies, something about where you live, through your writing?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that I have a missionary impulse. It's simply that when I first began writing, the whole geography of Canada, I'm talking about, you know, the 60s and 70s, in part was being filled in by regional writers who were writing about the places that they lived, mm-hmm. whether it was the Maritimes or British Columbia or the prairies or like Alice Munro, you know, southern Ontario. I think a lot of writers in that time period felt that it was important to do that. And I've never lost that sense of importance about writing about the place where I lived, which doesn't mean that I think it's more important or better than any other place. I simply think that it's a place that needs to be recognized.
And the way people view this part of your part of the world is probably shaped by your writing. I mean, how does that make you feel?
Oh, and you know, it actually, it sort of makes me, it gives me an odd feeling when somebody says that, because that world I carry around in my head,
yeah.
And the idea that other people are actually maybe seeing it at least a little bit the way I do is a strange concept for me to get hold of. Now, having said that, I know how many writers have shaped my ideas about their places. You know, when I think of the southern United States, I think of Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor. You know, when I think of say, Nebraska, I think of Willa Cather, or, you know, southwestern Ontario, it's Alice Munro, or the Maritimes, it's David Adams Richards. But it is, I must confess, it's a surprising thought that maybe the way my part of the world is regarded is at least in part seeing it in some way through my own eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of the craft of writing a short story, do you go into the process of writing one with the length in mind, that it has to be a certain number of words or number of pages, say?
No. I mean, what I have a sense that something's a short story when I feel that there's an intense focus. And by that I mean that the story I want to tell is a story that's usually limited in terms of the number of characters, that it might be focused on one character or two characters or three characters. Then basically I just write until I think that the ground that I wanted to cover or needed to cover has been covered. So some of these short stories are actually quite long stories. There's only a few of them that are you know, comparatively short. And I think that one of the reasons why they are longer stories is that I thought that the characters that I was writing about, because in part I was writing about people who had lived longer lives, that their lives needed to be gone into in a little bit more depth than, say, the stories that I was writing when I was in my 30s.
And did you find the process of writing, is that as enjoyable as it was, say, when you started your career?
I think it's harder. I think that the more you know about writing, the more you worry about doing it well. When I was younger, I guess I could sum it up was that I just wanted to get things out. There were things that I felt that I needed to say. I wanted to say them well. There's no question about that. But I didn't think to the same degree or in the same detail about how I was going to say them as I do now.
There's a certain reflective quality in the stories in this book, and I'm curious to know what you might think the younger reader, say a male half your age maybe, who would read this book, what you would want them to take away from it.
I think that what I would want them to take away with it is what, you know, what my response was to one of your earlier questions when you asked me about what character did I learn the most about. I think that in part I would hope that younger males or females reading these stories, what they might take away from it is maybe a better understanding of their own parents, of their own fathers, in terms of the stories that are written, you know, from the perspective of say, men in their 60s or late 50s.
We began the interview talking about looking behind us, looking in the past. Let's look ahead. What's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a novel. I haven't you know, I haven't gotten very far into it. I've only got, you know, 3 or 4 chapters written, so I don't know if it's going to get up on its legs and run or not. I hope it does, but I'm chipping away at that. I'm a slow writer, so, you know, if this novel takes hold of me, or I take hold of this novel, that's what I envision doing for the next 3 or 4 years.
Guy Vanderhaeg, it's been such a pleasure to have talked to you today, and I'm enjoying this book a great deal. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Well, thank you very much.
The book is called Daddy Lennon and Other Stories. It's published by McClelland and Stewart. Its author, Guy Vanderhaeg, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.